As beloved listeners know, we've been covering the story of what China is up to in Africa, among other places, over the past few years. But although the story is about Africa and China, it's about what some Africans are doing in China. Fascinated to find out that there's a large population of Africans living in Guangzhou in China. Astonished because I saw no evidence of this on various trips in the not-too-recent past, but they're from Nigeria, Somalia, Kenya, Mali, to mention, but a few, and it seems that we're not the only people trying to cash in on the Chinese economy. They're not, for the most part, living the high life of a wealthy expatriate, anything but. They're traders purchasing cheap goods, knock-off goods, to send back to their home countries, and this sort of work is, as I suggested earlier, part of low-end globalization. To explain to us the significance of the trade and the complicated relationships being established between Africans and Chinese, I'm pleased to welcome Gordon Matthews. Gordon's a professor in anthropology at the Chinese University of Hong Kong, and he's the author of this book I'm going to hold up to the microphone so you can all see it. Isn't radio a wonderful medium? It's called The World in Guangzhou, Africans and Other Foreigners in South China's Global Marketplace, published by the University of Chicago Press. Gordon, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be on.
Before we talk about your on-ground research, let's talk about the history of this fine city, because it's been a trading center for millennia.
It has indeed been a trading center for millennia, and you look at accounts from 1,000 and 2,000 years ago, and you do indeed see evidence of trade, particularly in more recent history in the 19th century, when you had vast numbers of traders going into the Pearl River and anchoring in Hongs on the Pearl River to trade. That was a huge industry. But since 1949, that's been pretty much shut down until the late 1980s and early 1990s, when it's begun to open up again.
So long history as a trading center, and of course, previously known as Canton.
Yes, exactly.
Canton. Most listeners still know it as Canton, I must say. Now, the government, why did it try to put a stop to it on several occasions?
Well, one reason, of course, is that at least since 1949, China was undergoing a proletarian revolution. And this meant that there wasn't much room for capitalism. But it also meant there wasn't much room for foreigners. There was no place for foreigners in China. And, you know, I live in Hong Kong, and in Hong Kong, it's said that people used to go to a mountain overlooking the Chinese border in the 1960s and 1970s and just look in. What's going on in China? Because that's the only way it could be seen. But of course, as you know, with China's signing of the WTO and so on, China began to open up, and that's why there are Africans in Guangzhou.
You know, it's interesting that China is so monocultural. There are exceptions. There's a very famous community of Jews who have been living in central China for centuries, and one also should factor in some, albeit reluctant, Tibetans. When did the Nigerians and other Africans start to arrive?
In the late 1990s. The first population began coming in, and it got quite large. I would estimate that at present there are probably 20,000 Africans in Guangzhou, and I'd say that Nigerians form the largest group. So it's not huge, but it's not tiny either.
I've seen some figures somewhere here, jotted them down, which say it can be as high as 300,000, but that might just be hyperbole. Or is there a seasonal factor?
That's hyperbole. People love to exaggerate. Mass media in China loves to exaggerate, and some scholars have too, unwittingly. The real figure came out during the Ebola epidemic, when the Chinese government, the Guangzhou government, felt obliged to give an accurate figure. And at that time, which was an off-season, they came out with 15,000. Because it was an off-season, I would give it more the number of 20,000 Africans living in Guangzhou at the average period of residence in Guangzhou. Now, it's always tough to know because there's no accurate figures. The Chinese government mentions everybody who comes in and counts them at least once, but they might have gone in six or eight times over the course of the year.
Culture shock. For most Chinese, have never seen a black face.
Indeed. And I have seen an old Chinese man walk into an African restaurant and begin desperately rubbing the skin of the guy I was talking to, seeing if the black skin comes off.
What are they buying on their trips to Guangzhou?
They're buying absolutely everything. I'd say mobile phones and clothing are probably the most common, but anything can be bought. And one thing about Guangzhou, unlike anywhere else in the world I know of, is you can take a sample to a factory and have them make 1,000 or 20,000 of that sample and give it back to you, and then you can send it back to your home country. That doesn't happen in most places where you buy retail. No, in China, take it to the factory, have them make it.
You call this trading, as I quoted before, low-end globalization. A riff on that term, if you please.
Well, it's low-end because it's not always illegal. A lot of it is not, but it's semi-legal. I mean, I think of low-end globalization as not being, you know, the mass corporations like Samsung and Apple with their millions of employees and billions in advertising budgets. No, low-end globalization is where you buy copies or knockoffs with a few friends, you send them back using part of a container, those goods are for sale in street stalls or on blankets in the marketplace in your hometown in Karachi or Lagos or Nairobi. That's what low-end globalization is, and that's what you see among these traders, among other things.
But you'd also factor in the presence of companies like McDonald's and Coke with their big advertising budgets, because they're trying to expand their market with ordinary Chinese people.
Well, that's all part of it, but that's a different world. I mean, you ask about low-end globalization, and one dominant factor is most of the goods bought in China are knockoffs, in Guangzhou are knockoffs. They are copies of the design of original goods, like Apple phones. About 20% are formally copies with the logo of that brand name. So that's one aspect where this is clearly illegal, but you can bribe Chinese customs and get through, and certainly you can bribe in customs in African countries. So that makes it distinctly different from going to your McDonald's and you will not get a copy Big Mac.
It's interesting, isn't it, that the knockoff business isn't what it used to be. Often the knockoffs are pretty damn good, whether they're, you know, handbags or watches. And semi-legal is exactly right, because there are vast emporia in almost every Chinese city I've been in, which are crowded with locals and tourists buying knockoffs.
Yes, yes, indeed. Yeah. And there's several reasons for this. One is that there's not a whole lot of enforcement. You can buy these without much impunity. These are often very good products, and they might be as low as 10% of the price of the original, or for a phone, maybe 40%. But who wouldn't buy one? They work. This, I might mention, is China's great benefit to the developing world, because the U.S., Europe, Japan, Australia doesn't make these goods for giving to the developing world, selling to the developing world, but China sure does.
Okay, let's talk about the cultural strains, the fracture lines. How do Africans and Chinese get along, and how indeed do they communicate? I was astonished to learn from you that the lingua franca amongst Africans is English.
Yeah, and it's not surprising it would be English, because, you know, most African countries, the majority of African countries, were colonized by the British. Certainly a country like Kenya, for example, you know, English speaking is remarkably good. What's most surprising to me is how few traders learn Chinese, even if they're in China for quite a while. And the level of Chinese in these particular African neighborhoods has gone way, way up, as well as levels of Portuguese and levels of French and levels of Arabic. So linguistically, it's gotten a lot easier to trade. Still, though, there are vast linguistic, but even more vast cultural barriers. And it's really tough for these traders to go in a plane over a 24-hour period to suddenly wind up in Guangzhou trying to make money. That's a tough thing to do.
And of course, there is a profound mutual ignorance. You describe some Chinese being so bigoted that they hold their noses on the bus.
Yeah. And, you know, that's racism, but it's a little different from racism, say, in the U.S. towards blacks or in Australia towards indigenous peoples and so on, because it's a racism often born of complete and total ignorance. But, you know, we cannot deny that there is a degree of racism. What I found, though, is that the racism is often having less to do with a person's skin color than the color of a passport. So if you're a Nigerian guy but have an Australian or a UK or a US passport, you're not going to experience nearly as much prejudice as if you have a Nigerian passport or a Kenyan passport, for example.
I'm talking to Gordon Matthews, who's a professor of anthropology at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. In the case of arguments between Chinese suppliers and African purchasers, it's hard for the Africans to go to the cops. And you tell us that there are designated peacemakers to sort out arguments.
Well, there are, but these are tough. The designated peacemakers, for example, in the Nigerian community, work more with Nigerian quarrels, but it's kind of tough to do with a quarrel with the Chinese. And one great problem in the trade is that, of course, both Africans and Chinese would like to cheat their counterpart to make more money. But the Chinese have all the weapons for cheating, much more than Africans do. So a common refrain among Africans is Chinese cheat. And it's not because most do cheat, but only because courts really aren't available. Police, if you talk to them, they might not be in favor of the Chinese trader necessarily, but they probably will say, hey, solve it yourselves. So how do you solve these problems?
Many of the Africans are, of course, quite religious, either Muslim or Christian. That must also create problems. For example, one observes that it's customary in China to celebrate a business deal with alcohol or indeed with sex.
Yes, indeed. One Kenyan trader commented to me that, look, I'm a Muslim. I can't smoke. I can't drink. And then after we sign a deal and we've smoked and drunk, I'm supposed to go with my Chinese to a brothel and have a happy ending. I don't want a happy ending. Now, I need to say that Africans do this kind of thing just as much as Chinese do. Africans are hardly saints here. But this is a cultural gap that it seems perfectly natural to smoke and drink, if not have sex, after a deal is signed. That's what Chinese among themselves do. But for an African Muslim particularly, that's a very strange thing to be doing.
I wish we had time to talk about some of the individuals you've singled out, Kingsley, Omar. There's a long list of the most fascinating humans, but we'll have to skip that because we've only got a few minutes left. Tell me about the African women trading in Guangzhou.
Well, it's interesting that many of the women, unlike a number of the men, come to Guangzhou, trade, and then go back. So it's harder to get to know the women because they might be there 20 days or 30 days. You know, they come in, buy the product, and leave. A lot more of the men want to stay. And sometimes they stay by getting work visas. Sometimes they stay illegally. And often these are the guys who become involved with Chinese women. And when you see a Chinese-African marriage, overwhelmingly it's an African man and a Chinese woman, exactly because of this. The women, the African women generally abide by the law more than African men do, unless they become sex workers, and that's a whole other category.
Do you think this little pocket of Guangzhou could be the beginning of a multicultural China?
I doubt it. And I doubt it because the police have been cracking down quite a bit. Basically, what we see, and I know you've dealt with Chinese in Africa quite a bit on your program, what we see is that Chinese and Africans are competing to be the middleman, because the middleman makes all the money. I know some of my African friends go to get their visa renewed in Guangzhou, and the customs official, the immigration official, will tell them, hey, look, why do you bother coming here? Go back to Kampala. Go back to Nairobi. Go back to Lagos. We'll make Chinese factories there, and we'll make the goods you need. You can buy them at home. And of course, Chinese would prefer that because money, again, goes to the middleman. So there's a competition here, and I think China does not really want to have many Africans in Guangzhou. They don't mind if Africans come to Guangzhou for a month, but they certainly don't want most Africans to stay for longer.
So of course, your term, low-end globalization, is on show in other places. It can be observed in Turkey, Bangkok, Dubai, etc.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It exists around the world. It probably exists in pockets in Sydney, too. It's hardly unique to Guangzhou, but you see a lot of it in Guangzhou.
Okay, so little by little, slowly, perhaps imperceptibly, China is going to have to adjust to living in the global world it seeks and will inevitably dominate.
Well, we'll see. I mean, look at a country like Japan. You know, we're old enough, I think, to remember when people were worried about Japan taking over the world, you know, in the 1980s. And it was thought Japan's going to let in people. Well, no. Japan lets in a few outsiders, including me. I'm speaking from Japan, but not very many. China may do the same thing. China can keep foreigners out to a significant extent and yet still dominate the world economically because, after all, Chinese go everywhere else and send their products everywhere else.
People also forget, of course, that China itself doesn't need to do knockoffs. It is an immensely creative country and has been for thousands of years.
Yes, yes. And you're absolutely right in that comment. China's stage of knockoffs is temporary. Remember, 60 years ago, Japan was the country that knocked off products, 70 years ago. Then after that, it was Korea, maybe 40 years ago. Now it's China. China's going to outgrow this as the Chinese economy becomes less and less like the economy of Nigeria and Kenya and Pakistan and more like the economy of the U.S., Australia, and Japan.
You know, I have always held the heretical view, Gordon, that Australia is a knockoff society. We steal almost every pop cultural idea from the United States and at best hybridize. But, you know, the whole country, the whole world, in fact, is involved in these sorts of exchanges.
Well, you're absolutely right when it comes to stealing culture. We all do it. When it comes to stealing copyrighted ideas, now this is an interesting idea. Many people I talk to are appalled by the fact that Chinese make knockoff goods and copy goods. I personally view it as a good thing. Not maybe not copies, but knockoffs. Because if it weren't for China, no other country would be making the developing world develop. You know, Africa used to have a few million phones. Now it has several hundred million mobile phones. Many African people have entered the global informational world, and they've done that because of China. That's a pretty noble achievement, I think.
It's been a huge help in India as well. These
absolutely
the cheaper phones. Look, that's a very well argued case, Gordon. Incidentally, how are things currently in Honkers?
In Hong Kong, interesting question. we slowly but surely see ourselves being assimilated to the mainland. All I can say is that as a professor in Hong Kong, I remain remarkably free to teach what I want. I can say things that I might not be able to say in the United States or Australia. So I'm still happy, but I also have my antenna up for what may be increasing infringement.
Well, you're always welcome to say anything you like on this program, Gordon. Gordon Matthews, Professor in Anthropology at the Chinese University of Hong Kong and author of The World in Guangzhou, Africans and Other Foreigners in South China's Global Marketplace, and Academia Being Global as well. It's published by the University of Chicago Press.